Cox was a hero, but what he'd brought over would be used for one of the largest killings in modern times. The Würzburg radar was even more advanced than British specialists had anticipated. It poured out waves of a bare 10 inches from peak to peak. Those small, precise waves could be aimed with far more accuracy. The chain home system, with its yards-long waves, was antiquated by comparison. That was bad enough, but the serial numbers Cox had captured allowed for a very disturbing calculation. Some of the replacement parts in the Würzburg had been installed in December, and the serial numbers on those parts were close together, suggesting that not many machines were in operation. But the replacement parts that had been installed in February had serial numbers much further apart, which ominously suggested that many more spare parts were being produced to supply a much greater number of Würzburg machines now in use. That explained the attacks the RAF was suffering. The multitudes of new Würzburgs, with their ability to spot incoming aircraft and their uncannily accurate guidance of searchlight beams, were turning the sky over Europe into a killing zone for Allied flyers. But then, and could the full consequences of this discovery ever have been averted? The London analysts found a weakness in the Würzburg. Its settings were very hard to change, and at first no one knew why. The clue came from the young operator that Cox had helped to capture. He was very young and willing to talk. We spent the afternoon, Reginald V. Jones recalled, sitting on the floor with him, fitting the various pieces together and listening to his comments. But he was also almost entirely ignorant of how radar worked. He seemed to have spent more time inside prison than out of it. Britain had a lot of skilled amateur radio operators to draw from, but in Germany, it had long been strictly forbidden for private civilians to build radios. Nor could German women be recruited, even if they had an aptitude for technical jobs. In a dictatorship obsessed with eugenics, they were to remain fertile, demure, and at home. German radars had to be very simple, Jones gradually realized, for there weren't enough educated men available to repair and operate radars of any complexity. In other words, Germany's most advanced radar had been built to be an immensely sophisticated, idiot-proof piece of machinery. It was the rigid nature of Germany's radar that made Jones and others in the Air Ministry believe they could turn Germany's technical advances back against them. For several months already, the RAF had been considering a weapon that at first seemed too simple to be of any great importance. It consisted merely of large numbers of aluminum strips, like long pieces of confetti, that could be dropped from an airplane. The weapon's original code name was Window, but it later became known as Chaff, the name we'll use. If these strips were released from a fleet of planes, researchers believed they could act as a flurrying cloud, sending back an immense number of electric pulses. Watson Watt knew who was gunning to use Chaff. It was Arthur Harris, the head of RAF Bomber Command. Harris had long known what Chaff could do, but he'd held back, for Chaff seemed to be the sort of weapon that could be used with full effectiveness only once. After a while, the enemy surely would work out ways to distinguish the slow fluttering of the chaff from the faster speeding planes. They might also use chaff technology to jam British radar. There had been an impasse, a bit like everyone having poison gas but no one using it. But what the Brunewald raid had revealed was that Germany's radar sets, and especially the super-accurate Würzburg, were so rigidly calibrated that it would be hard for any of the operators to adapt to this new weapon. It's doubtful that there was a more disagreeable character on the Allied military side in World War II than Harris. He could be kind to his immediate family, but he had few friends and no hobbies. He never read a book, and he never listened to music. He had only one great passion in his life, and it was a hatred. It wasn't directed against Germany. It seems, from the evidence of his actions, that it was directed against blue-collar workers. Harris was an extreme reactionary. Like many well-off individuals of his time, he often expressed great distaste for the British working classes, and for their German counterparts as well. The writings of even many ostensibly gentle literary intellectuals from this period are disturbing when it comes to this topic. Indeed, they bear some resemblance to the racial hatred that Japan and America came to feel toward each other as their battles in the Pacific went on. Many officers aware of his plans were appalled at what he wanted to do. The United States, for example, was bombing enemy factories, railroads, and docks. Often there were vast mistakes, and civilians were killed. But at least in Europe, that was never the goal of entire campaigns, and American flight officers who consistently missed their navigation targets could be removed from duty. The Royal Navy also wanted to use whatever bombers were available to concentrate on submarine factories and shipyards, and, if possible, to use bombers to target enemy submarines or surface ships on the seas. Harris saw it differently. He wanted to kill people, quite as much as he wanted to destroy buildings or equipment. The huge supplies of high explosives and incendiaries that the RAF was accumulating were to be dropped on the workers themselves in the houses where they lived. That, he was convinced, was the most effective way to destroy the enemy's power. Watson Watt was frantic. This was never what he'd devised radar for, but he was just an underling now, and despite a last desperate rush of words and memos, he could merely watch as the remarkable defensive weapon he'd helped create was lifted from his control. He even tried getting Henry Tizard to help him. Tizard was the man who'd headed the original committee that created Britain's radar system, and that had been so crucial in the 1940 Battle of Britain. There was little question what city Harris would select to show what his force could do. Hamburg was a huge industrial center with lots of densely concentrated worker housing. It was also on the North Sea, with the River Elbe going through it. Navigating at the border where land and sea come together is especially easy, for land and water respond very differently to radar, as we'll see. Harris gave instructions to guide his RAF navigators as they entered airspace over the city. To the south of the Elbe were the factories and famous U-boat construction yards. Those were the targets that the Royal Navy and Tizard wanted destroyed. But Harris's pilots had express orders to avoid them and stay on the north side of the city. There were no war factories there, only row after row of tenements in six-story blocks, much like London's Old East End or parts of New York's Lower East Side. Some of the men there were employed at the factories, but the majority of inhabitants were older people, women, and, since there had been only partial evacuation to the countryside, lots and lots of children. At 11 p.m. on July 27th, the RAF planes were far over the dark North Sea, still unseen. In the radio headsets of the air crew, broadcasts sent rippling out from England led to electrons vibrating over minuscule distances and then magnified into audible sound. Inside the downward-looking radars, more electrons were hurtling through their miniature copper-bound channels, flinging down tight radio waves. There are relatively few loose electrons in water to respond, so when the oscilloscopes showed only blackness, the navigators knew that they were over the cold waters of the North Sea.